Okay. Let's cultivate our motivation. And really appreciating the bodhicitta and the opportunity to hear teachings on the precious bodhicitta. Then let's approach this topic with a lot of enthusiasm and eagerness and a real sense of the fortune we have at hearing these teachings. Because imagine for a minute not having heard teachings on bodhicitta, not even having heard the word bodhicitta or altruistic intention. Then where would your life be? And where would your Dharma practice be if even earlier this life you had not heard of the bodhicitta? Just think about that for a minute. And really have a special sense of joy at hearing teachings on this topic. And so, of course, let's do it with the bodhicitta motivation and the long-term intention to be of the greatest benefit to sentient beings and thus to attain full enlightenment in order to do so. You know, it's interesting that with the prison work I do, one of the things that speaks very loudly to many of the inmates why they turn to Buddhism is the discussion of bodhicitta and the talk of compassion. Now, you'd think for some people who had, you know, said that they had raped or murdered or whatever in the past, you know, because of whatever happened in previous lives and their upbringing this life and the afflictions in the mind. But what spoke to them spoke so loudly and clearly was this talk of compassion and the idea of making one's life useful for others. And I think that for many of the inmates, that may have played a fact in feeling very lost earlier on in their life, is that there had been nothing in their lives to say, how do you make your life useful? And I know for me personally, you know, this was one of the big things that I was searching for very much before I met the Dharma, is how do I make my life meaningful? You know, because after I die, you know, then so what? You have a lot of pleasures, but after you die, it doesn't matter. So what's going to bring some long-term meaning to my life? And so the bodhicitta is the thing that really speaks quite loudly to that. And I've been doing some study recently. One of my Tibetan teachers asked me to learn more about the Theravada tradition. So I've been doing some study, and I really enjoy it, and it's a wonderful complement to understanding many things that we hear about in the Sanskrit tradition that aren't explained fully. You know, I'm seeing in the Pali tradition and seeing many quotations that we use in the Lam Rim and finding them in the Pali Suttas. And it's a very exciting process. But one thing that I've really been seeing is, you know, following this track in the Pali Sutras to become a stream enterer, a once returner, a non-returner, and then an arhat. And then the discussion of what happens when you've become an arhat. And first of all, you know, sometimes people in the Mahayana tradition look down at the arhats, because sometimes in the Mahayana Sutras they're they're not expressed very favorably. But the Buddha himself said in the Pali Sutras that, you know, that his disciples are there to teach the Dharma for the benefit of the world and the welfare of the world and with compassion. So it's quite clear, you know, that they have compassion and they want to benefit others. But in thinking about, you know, the goal of arhatship and the discussion of what happens, you know, when you become an arhat, because, you know, when you become an arhat, okay, your afflictions are eliminated. As it's presented in the Pali Canon, you still may have some karma left on your mind stream, but it can't ripen in future rebirths because your craving and your ignorance have been eliminated. So in the lifetime when you become an arhat, it's called nirvana with remainder, the remainder being the tainted aggregates that you took at the beginning of that lifetime, because when you were born at that the beginning of that lifetime, you were still under the influence of ignorance, and so your five aggregates are tainted or contaminated in that way. And they don't get purified, they're still the same aggregates you have when you're born, so it's called arhatship with remainder of those five tainted aggregates. And then when you die, you become an arhat without the remainder of those five aggregates. But it's not quite sure what happens. It's said that kind of you get nibbanaized, you know, that somehow, you know, the Buddha was quite strict, you know, it's not that you cease totally when you attain arhatship, nirvana without remainder, you know. I mean, he was quite clear about, you know, when people were asking, you know, does an arhat or does a tathagata exist after death, not exist, both and neither. You know, he very clearly negated the possibility of total non-existence. But it's hard to, you know, they don't have a, in the Pali tradition, they don't really say what happens to the arhat, you know, it's just they shed these five aggregates, and so then there's nothing with which to identify the arhat with. Because without the five contaminated aggregates, there's, you know, nothing. Where do you say there's a person? And yet they're not totally non-existent. Okay, that's how it's presented in the Pali Canon. In the Sanskrit canon, or at least in the Tibetan tradition, when you have arhatship without remainder, you abide in meditative equipoise on emptiness for a long, long time. Okay, so consciousness still exists, the person still exists, it's merely labeled in dependence upon those aggregates, which are, you know, not tainted aggregates, but not completely purified aggregates, although they're free from ignorance, so they're untainted. Yeah, they would be untainted. They still have the cognitive obscurations, but they would be untainted. You know, and abides in the nirvana for eons in your meditative equipoise until eventually the Buddha wakes you up and says, you know, you have to work for the benefit of sentient beings. Your job isn't really done. Yeah, so that's from a Mahayana viewpoint, what's happened to the arhats. And in doing all this study, I realized that there's something about just arhat, that kind of arhatship, that it's wonderful to be out of samsara, but I don't feel super inspired by it, you know? Because, yes, samsara is awful, and yes, I want to get out, but then to stay in my own meditative equipoise afterwards, then there's still the thing of what's the purpose? You know? I accomplished my own purpose and got out of samsara, but what's the purpose? You know, in the long term. Yeah? And so I think that's where bodhicitta, at least for me personally, gives some kind of vision that goes on into the future that is really how to make your existence quite valuable and meaningful over a long period of time. Because as a Buddha, then you have the ability to manifest in many different forms and many different bodies to work for the benefit of sentient beings. So you're always busy. Mm-hmm. So then, it you know, of me with my questioning mind, I look and I can see, well, you know, maybe it's because part of my nature, it's like I don't like to sit still. Yeah? It's like I want to do something. So maybe, you know, the idea of Buddhahood appeals to me because I like to do something. Yeah? So I have to watch out for that because it has to be a pure motivation and not just a, you know, I can't sit still, let's do something motivation. And I was also thinking that, you know, there's also in generating the wish to become a Buddha, if we haven't realized emptiness, there's still this thing of I'm becoming a Buddha, you know. There's still so easily this grasping at inherent existence, you know, because we have so strongly this feeling of, well, I need to be something. So if I can't, you know, I'm fed up with being an ordinary person, so I'll be a bodhisattva or a Buddha. But still there's this thing of, you know, I have to be something. Yeah. Whereas when we really think about realizing emptiness, it's like you aren't anything. Yeah, you aren't anything. What we label the person is really just something that's labeled. There's absolutely no person there. But when we don't look, when we say, I want to, when we aren't analyzing, when we say, I want to become a bodhisattva, there's the idea that, you know, because when you really think about the emptiness of true existence, you aren't anything. You know, there is no person there. There's the five aggregates there, but there is absolutely nothing personal about the five aggregates. And in addition, when you look at the five aggregates, you can't even find them. Yeah? All you find is their part. And when you look at their parts, you can't even find them. Yeah. So, you know, if you really have an analytical mind, it's impossible to hold on to being something. But when you don't, when you aren't analyzing, our mind that always wants to feel like, hey, I exist, well, now it's like, I'm going to exist as a bodhisattva. Yeah? So, of course, that's better than, you know, I'm going to be a cab driver, or I'm going to be a capitalist, or I'm going to be a doctor, you know, like these things. But, you know, we're still wanting, there's still the grasping at true existence that's going on that we really have to eliminate. Yeah? So, but when you know, so what I'm talking about is like when you're aiming for Buddhahood, little ways that you could, that I'm discovering where you could go off, you know, because you're still grasping at true existence and get sidetracked there, or because you can't sit still, then you want to do something for sentient beings. So, you know, motivation is not 100%. It's better than it was before, but it's not 100%. Okay? So all sorts of things like this. And similarly, in the path to arhatship, there I'm noticing too all sorts of ways that people can go off, because you know you're meditating very strongly there on the three characteristics, that things are impermanent, that they're in the unsatisfactory in nature, and that they are without a self. Yeah, and you very easily can go, you know, in when you're understanding what samsara is and the nature of samsara, how it's really impermanent, how it's unsatisfactory. You know, if you're not real clear on your wisdom, you could very easily go in, and because it does say, you know, you develop the knowledge seeing samsara as fearful. You develop the knowledge seeing samsara as dangerous. You know, that if we're not completely right on our knowledge, then we get into this psychological fear and the psychological danger. Yeah? And then that's, then people get kind of this thing of, I'm rejecting the world. Because sometimes the Theravada language can come off like that. You know, you're rejecting the world because it's fearsome and dangerous and things. And if people don't understand what that means properly, And if they have a tendency themselves towards, you know, aversion and rejection, they could easily, you know, go off base there. Yeah. Whereas actually what's meant is that you see the unsatisfactory nature with wisdom, and you see that it's not that the world is dangerous, but one's own clinging to it is dangerous. One's own ignorance about it is dangerous. And therefore you want to escape from the origin of the suffering, you know, as well as the suffering, but it's not because the world's inherently bad or evil or something like that. So somebody could go off track on, you know, on doing that path as well if you don't understand these things. So what I'm saying, just to sum up, is we have to really watch our mind and be aware of our motivation and our understanding at all times, so that very afflicted mental states don't mix with our understanding of the Dharma, so that we misunderstand the Dharma, okay? And either bring grasping into existence, into wanting to be a bodhisattva, or bringing psychological, you know, escapism into wanting to be an arhat, you know, those kinds of things. Okay, so that's one point. And then just the point for me personally, as I was saying, that, you know, for me, the idea of bodhicitta just seems really inspiring, because, you know, okay, you do attain your own nirvana, but then you get to benefit so many beings. So it seems to have a meaning that goes beyond my own nirvana. You know, because until my own nirvana, okay, you know, I can hold that out as something to work for. Maybe I'm just a goal-oriented person, you know. Yeah, high-achieving Jewish girl. So, you know, imprinted solidly. You know, but, okay, but, you know, so that can be, you know, one goal of, you know, arhat. But then you attain that, then so what? You know, in a way. Whereas if you attain Buddhahood, I don't think you get to Buddha and say, so what? Mm-hmm. You know, it's like there's too many things to do for sentient beings. Yeah. And since sentient beings are infinite, and sentient beings' afflictions are infinite, and the Dharma paths are infinite, you know, then it's going to take a lot of work to help. Yeah, you have your work cut out for you, mm-hmm. and there's no days off, mm-hmm. yeah, and there's no sick days, and there's no overtime compensation. In fact, you don't get paid anything at all. Can you imagine? Yeah. So, okay, so let's go on to our topic this week. That was a bit of an introduction there. We had a couple of questions, and then I'll go back to the text. So one person was, they were getting confused because I was saying that when we say great vehicle, that vehicle is a consciousness. When we say path, you know, path of seeing, path of meditation, path is a consciousness. You know, grasping it at true existence is a consciousness. Self-centered thought is a consciousness. So they're saying, I'm confused. What's a consciousness? Mm-hmm. You know, well, I'm using the word consciousness interchangeably with mind, so it's just something that's clear and aware by nature. Yeah? And so anger is a consciousness. Yeah? It's not a primary consciousness. We have six primary consciousnesses, you know, eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, and mind. But, you know, anger is a mental factor, so it's a consciousness. So there are some consciousnesses that can be abandoned on the path. You don't abandon the clear and knowing isn't of that consciousness. It's not something that it gets abandoned. But the afflicted part of that consciousness is something that gets abandoned. Okay? That's one question. The other question is, can you explain how contentment works in relationship to dissatisfaction? Is it an antidote or a way of coping? Okay. Perhaps contentment counteracts the inappropriate attention. Can you talk about contentment in relationship to pain, since the mind is the one that experiences pain, not the body? Okay, so another question with about 15 sub-questions in it. Okay, so contentment and dissatisfaction. These are words that we can bring them we can think of them in two ways. You know, there's a good kind of dissatisfaction and an afflicted kind of dissatisfaction. There's a good kind of contentment and an afflicted kind of contentment. Okay? So if we look at dissatisfaction, when we're dissatisfied due to attachment, you know, and our complaining mind takes over and our whining mind takes over, I don't like this, and I don't like that, and I want more, and I want better, and how come they have it and I don't, and how come I have to do this and they don't, and it's not fair, and okay, that kind of mind, you know that one. Okay, that kind of dissatisfaction, clearly afflicted. Okay, but when we look at what cyclic existence is and how the nature of cyclic existence is unsatisfactory and it's insecure and it's getting born and dying again and again, and you are dissatisfied with remaining in cyclic existence, that kind of dissatisfaction is a virtuous mind. It's a mind of renunciation that wants to attain liberation. So being dissatisfied with cyclic existence is something virtuous. Okay? Now, in terms of, but do you see, we use the English word dissatisfaction in both scenarios, but it's actually quite different, isn't it? But the English word fits both ways. Okay. So similarly with contentment, yeah, if we're just content with our samsara, you know, yeah, samsara is pretty good, you know, I have a job and a family and an income and things are kind of going along, and yeah, you know, it still is impermanent, but I've got a pretty good life, and you know, we're kind of coasting along, being very complacent. Yeah, that kind of contentment is clearly something that's afflicted, isn't it? Yeah, I mean, we're content with you know, drinking poison because we don't realize it's poison. Well, you know, that's something's wrong. Okay. But when you have a state of contentment that says, you know, there's no sense hassling about these small things of samsara that come and go and come and go, yeah, and so I'm just going to let that be, but focus my eyes on my long-term goal, yeah, and stop complaining about this and that and whining about this and that. That kind of contentment, you know, that, you know, you're content with your worldly situation. You know, you're not looking for more status, you're not looking for more possessions, you're not looking for another love affair. You're content with what you have. Then that kind of contentment is something good. Yeah, because it gives you, it's very pacifying to the mind and gives you a lot of space to go forward in your practice. Okay? So in the case of pain, when you experience pain, yeah, then you might say, well, how can I be content with pain? Yeah. Well, in one way, you can bring forth the mind, you can use the pain to generate renunciation and the determination to be free by saying, why do I have pain? It's because I haven't done anything to get out of cyclic existence. Yeah? I haven't been unsatisfied with cyclic existence. I've been content with cyclic existence. That's why I'm experiencing this pain. And so then you use that pain to become dissatisfied with cyclic existence and to aim for liberation. Okay? At the same time that you have that kind of dissatisfaction, you can also be content in the sense of, I have this pain, it's the result of my own negative karma, I accept it. Let's, you know, go on and make my life meaningful and useful. And even I'm lying in bed, I'm going to practice the Dharma, and I can do the taking and giving meditation. And I'm, you know, not fighting the reality that I have this. Then that kind of contentment is something that's useful for us. Okay, so then you can be content and dissatisfied at the same time. You have the virtuous kind of dissatisfaction and the virtuous kind of contentment. Okay, got it? Okay. So, let's go on. Okay, so we'll read from the text now. So we're on the chapter about appreciating the value of the awakening mind, which is the entrance to the Mahayana, the great vehicle. Okay. By the way, okay, before I get there, you know me, I always have to have a distraction. Okay, this thing about great vehicle, yeah, because you find a lot in the Tibetan teachings, they say Mahayana and Hinayana. Okay, I don't want to hear anybody at the Abbey say that. Yeah, because what happens is it becomes a very detrimental way of talking about other Buddhist practitioners. Yeah, and it's very offensive to people, and I don't think that term should be used. Yeah, the way His Holiness talks about different Buddhist traditions now is he'll talk about the fundamental vehicle and then the Mahayana. Okay? Or you talk about the hearer vehicle, the Pratyeka Buddha vehicle, the Bodhisattva vehicle, those kinds of things. Yeah? So I think, what he often uses and what you hear me say is the Pali tradition, the Sanskrit tradition. Now that's a very general thing because all the things we're calling the Sanskrit tradition weren't necessarily in Sanskrit. Some of them were in Prakrit, some of them were in, you know, other Central Asian languages, but we're just kind of calling it Sanskrit because it's easier. Yeah, but that's what His Holiness often used to differentiate those two branches at least. Mm-hmm. Okay? So, and also, this thing about because you do find sometimes, it depends on the Mahayana scriptures, some of the later Mahayana scriptures tended to portray the arhats in a very disadvantageous way. And sometimes you hear people speaking about arhats as if they are just so self-centered and selfish and don't care beans about anybody else. And that is not true at all. Okay. The arhats have eliminated attachment, and they also have compassion. So they're much higher spiritually advanced than the rest of us are. So there's no reason to put them down. Okay? And there's no reason to put down people who aspire to become arhats, because that's what makes sense to them. Yeah? And that is according to their interest and their disposition and their faculties and so on. Yeah. And then this whole thing about, you know, the people in in the fundamental vehicle are selfish, but the Mahayana people are so compassionate. You know, I remember one time I was going to visit one country, and there had been a Mahayana Dharma Center who had invited me. But when I got there, they, for whatever reason, they didn't want to pay the airfare and reimburse the airfare. And so there was a temple, a Sri Lankan temple. When they heard about the situation, then they gave me the money for the airfare. Yeah, because all the compassionate Mahayanas were busy doing something else. So, this thing about kind of sticking your nose up in the air, I think is really, very unbecoming, you know. And so whether you practice in the fundamental vehicle or the Mahayana vehicle, because both vehicles have misunderstandings about each other, yeah. But the thing is that they all come from the Buddha. And so to criticize for the fundamental vehicle, to criticize the Mahayana, for the Mahayana, to criticize the fundamental vehicle, it's you're criticizing Buddha's teachings. It's like criticizing the Buddha. That ain't good. Yeah? So if we really respect the Buddha, and if we really respect that sentient beings have different dispositions, yeah, we want everybody to benefit according to what makes sense to them, then we should respect all of the traditions that come from the Buddha. Okay? And for that reason, we should even respect all religious traditions, because, you know, Buddhism isn't going to be the thing that excites everybody. So if somebody else finds another religious tradition that still teaches compassion and love and ethical conduct, that's very good. You know, we shouldn't criticize their tradition. Mm-hmm. Now, on points of theology or points of philosophy, there you can debate, okay? You know, because you debate. Do things exist this way? Do things exist that way? Is this a right understanding? Is that a right understanding? You know, but there you're using logic and reasoning in order to debate the nature of how things exist. But that's very different than criticizing a tradition that teaches ethical conduct and love and compassion, or criticizing a person who benefits from that kind of tradition. Okay? So you getting what I'm saying? So for religious harmony, we don't need to say all of the paths go up the same mountain. You know, or all of the paths lead down to the same valley. You know, I've found that sometimes people, to have religious harmony, they need to say, well, we're all getting to the same place. I don't know if we're all getting to the same place. I haven't even gotten to the goal of my own tradition, let alone understand the goal of other people's traditions. I have no idea if we're Christianity, Judaism, Islam, Wicca, and everybody else, what their goals are. I haven't even gotten to the end of the Buddhist goal. You know? So I can't say whether or not they're all going to the same place. And it doesn't really matter. Yeah? I don't think it matters anyway. The thing is that everybody benefits. That's the point. That people benefit from what they're doing, whether they're going to the same place or not. I don't know. Yeah. And I remember His Holiness said at one time, you know, one interreligious dialogue, you know, there was one Catholic priest who was kind of saying, you know, really drawing on the similarities and how much we're the same and this kind of thing, we're all going up to the same mountain. And His Holiness also said, you know, we don't need to be the same in order to get along. Mm. Yeah. So we don't need to say all the religions are the same in order to get along. I don't know if they're the same or not. Yeah. But they all nourish people spiritually, so I can respect all of them. Yeah? Communicating? You getting what I'm saying? Okay. Okay, now let's see if I can start the text. Okay. So our author says, so whether you are considered a practitioner of the great vehicle or not depends simply on whether you possess this attitude, meaning the bodhicitta. In fact, the great vehicle is indicated by nothing but the presence or absence of this very state of mind. So this is exactly the thing that either makes you a Mahayanist or doesn't, that makes you enter the bodhisattva vehicle or doesn't. The presence or absence of bodhicitta. Okay? In this context, the guide to the bodhisattva's way of life, who was authored by Shantideva, says, the instant the awakening mind is activated, those bound up in the prison of cyclic existence come to be known as children of the Buddhas gone to bliss. And today I have been born into the family of the Buddhas and have become a child of the awakened one. Now, what does it mean to be a child of the awakened one? Okay? Because we think, you know, I'm going back to, you know, inner child, or, you know, what's the story here? The idea is, in ancient societies, whatever the parent did, the child did. You know, you inherited the occupation of your parents. Yeah? So you were like a novice, a trainee under the guidance of your parents, because you took over the family business. So here, yeah, when you're a child of the Buddha, you are the junior who is training, who is going to, you know, take over. Quite, it's not like you're going to kick the Buddha out, but you're going to take over and join in the family, quote, quote, business of enlightening sentient beings. So that's why you're called a child of the Buddha. Okay? You join the family of the Buddha. You know, when they say, sometimes you read the scriptures, they'll say, oh, child of a good family. Yeah? What a good family there means, it doesn't mean, you know, that you were born in an aristocratic family or in a wealthy family. It means the family is the Buddha's family. Your lineage is the Buddha's lineage. Okay, that's what it's referring to. Okay, so the instant the awakening mind is activated, those bound up in the prison of cyclic existence come to be known as children of the Buddhas gone to bliss. And today I've been born into the family of the Buddhas and have become a child of the awakened ones. So when you generate bodhicitta, you become a child of the awakened ones. Okay, so you're still bound up in samsara at that point. Yeah, even though you may have spontaneous bodhicitta, if you're somebody who is newly practicing the Mahayana tradition, you're not free of samsara. Okay, there's two kinds of bodhisattvas. There's the bodhisattvas who are newly entering the Mahayana, going from ordinary beings into the Mahayana path, starting with the Mahayana path of accumulation. So the dividing line to enter the Mahayana path of accumulation is the spontaneous bodhicitta. Okay? So if you don't have any other realizations, you enter the Mahayana vehicle freshly in that way. It's also called being definite in the Mahayana. But then there's other people who practice the fundamental vehicle and become arhats. They realize emptiness. They eliminate the afflictive obscurations. They become arhats. And then when the Buddha calls them out of their meditative equipoise on emptiness, then they start all over at the beginning of the bodhisattva path, with the bodhisattva path of accumulation. So even though they've gone through the five paths, let's say, of the here, path of accumulation, preparation, seeing, meditation, and no more learning, which is arhatship, and even though they have realized emptiness, when they start the bodhisattva path, they have to start with the bodhisattva path of accumulation. Okay? So those bodhisattvas still have a realization of emptiness, even though they're on the path of accumulation. Okay? Whereas the bodhisattvas who are new don't have that realization of emptiness. But still, they say that the new bodhisattva is going to become a Buddha more quickly than the bodhisattva who became an arhat first and then came back to into the bodhisattva vehicle. Why? Because that person who has an arhat, who became an arhat, has to overcome that tendency of really seeking their own liberation. Yeah, because that's imprinted in them strongly, so they have to work more to eliminate that. And also because they have the tendency to just go into meditative equipoise on emptiness and stay there a long time, whereas the new bodhisattva is busy accumulating merit. And the person who became the arhat, who starts over at the beginning of the bodhisattva path, they still have to accumulate just as much merit as the new bodhisattva. Because it's the, you know, It's the accumulation of merit as well as the accumulation of wisdom that moves you along the bodhisattva path. Okay?
And it just seems like accumulating wisdom, you would generate a whole lot of merit along the way.
Yes, you do generate merit along the way. But you've spent your time generating wisdom, and you haven't spent it practicing generosity, doing all the practices like the ethics of benefiting sentient beings, the ethics of accumulating positive potential. You haven't practiced patience, because when you meet somebody who's quarrelsome, you just go into samadhi, you know. You haven't practiced the kind of joyous effort that a bodhisattva has. Yeah, you haven't done all these bodhisattva practices, which take a long time. So you have to spend a long time accumulating merit. Yeah. If you go on the hearer path, yeah, they say, what is it? If you become a stream enter in that life, then at most 7 more lifetimes. And then you're at arhatship. Yeah. And then sometimes you can accumulate merit for 3 lives and then that's it. Yeah. Whereas a bodhisattva on the sutra path, you have to accumulate merit for 3 countless great eons, a little bit longer. Yeah. And you see, this is also one of the reasons that makes the tantric path quicker, is because it combines wisdom and method in a certain way so that you can accumulate the merit more quickly. That's one of the factors that makes tantra very profound. There's other reasons too, but that's one special reason. Okay? But still, in the bodhisattva path, 3 countless great eons, you need to have some energy there. Okay? Yeah?
What about somebody who realizes emptiness and nidya or vajra?
Okay, usually if you're on the hearer path. Oh, that they've realized emptiness and then generate bodhicitta. Usually their realization of emptiness is a conceptual realization. It's not a direct perception. So they have a realization of emptiness, and that greatly aids their generation of bodhicitta. Okay? Because as we've, when I talked about in the Chandrakirti's homage to great compassion, 3 kinds of compassion, then you see there, especially in the 3rd compassion, compassion of the unapprehendable, that, if you see sentient beings as empty of true existence, it really helps you a lot in generating your compassion, makes your compassion much more profound. Yeah. Okay, then, but you still have to practice the wisdom and the bodhicitta together. Yeah? You're still on the bodhisattva path. You have to do the two together. That's why they say accumulate merit and accumulate wisdom. Both of them. This shows that as soon as you generate the awakening mind, you become a son or daughter of the conquerors. The life story of the exalted Maitreya also says, O child of my family, here are some analogies. The awakening mind is like a diamond, even a fragment of which surpasses all other kinds of valuable ornaments, such as gold, which retains the name diamond and can eradicate all poverty. So the idea is that a diamond is a diamond, even if it's a little small piece, and it's still a little bit of diamond is still can do things that a lot of gold can't do. Okay. O child of my family, in the same way, the precious diamond-like mind, which gives rise to omniscience, even when it is weak, outshines all the golden qualities adorning the hearers and solitary realizers. Because of it, you retain the name Bodhisattva and eradicate all poverty of cyclic existence. Okay? So even though in terms of wisdom, some of the arhats or the beings on the hearer vehicle maybe have a greater understanding of emptiness than the new bodhisattva, still the new bodhisattva becomes a child of the Buddha, and that their bodhicitta is like a diamond, because even though it's very small, it still outshines the gold of all the qualities of the arhat. So even though your conduct may not be distinguished, this is our author speaking, even though your conduct may not be distinguished, if you have engendered such a mind, you are referred to as a bodhisattva, an awakening warrior. Now, warrior, okay, the image of war. And you'll find this periodically through the bodhisattva path, that the image of war comes up. And the Buddha himself is known as the conqueror, yeah? And Shantideva, you know, you're fighting the afflictions and things like that. So just remember, it's an analogy. You don't have to get too bound up in it. Yeah. Sometimes people who, you know, we've been on so many peace marches that we can't relate to the warlike language. Yeah. But, you know, for some people it works well. And the idea of, you know, your real enemy is the self-centered mind, the self-grasping ignorance, not other sentient beings. Yeah. But it's just an analogy, so don't get upset by it. Okay? The protector Nagarjuna wrote in Precious Garland, "If you in the world wish to attain unsurpassable full awakening, the source is the awakening mind, which should be as stable as the king of mountains." And then the Vajrapani initiation tantra, okay, so here's from a tantra, also says, "O great bodhisattva, the great mysteries of this extremely vast mandala of Dharani, which are extremely profound, unfathomable, rare and secret, should not be revealed to evil beings. O Vajrapani, what you have said is unique and extremely rare. Therefore, how is one to explain it to those beings who have never heard it before?" To this, Vajrapani replied, "O Manjushri, at such a time that anyone who is engaged in meditation on the awakening mind has achieved that state of mind, then, O Manjushri, those who perform the activities of a bodhisattva, specifically the activities involving secret mantra, should enter into the Dharani mandala by receiving the great wisdom initiation. Anyone who has not accomplished the awakening mind should not engage in these practices. They should neither view nor enter the mandala. To them, the gestures and details of secret mantra should never be shown." Okay, what this means is that if you want to engage in the practice of Vajrayana, then you need to generate bodhicitta. Okay? So the best vehicle to receive the initiation in highest class tantra is, of course, somebody who has renunciation, full bodhicitta, you know, realization of emptiness. But as Holiness says, is if we wait until we have those, we may never, you know, not never, but not for a long time, take initiation. And since not all the Buddhas give tantra initiation, it's very valuable to at least take some tantra initiation in your lifetime to put those imprints on your mind. So to cultivate renunciation, bodhicitta, wisdom as best as you can. But, you know, this is really emphasizing that, you know, if you want to get somewhere in your Vajrayana practice, you really need to have bodhicitta in order to do so. And you can see why, you know, because bodhicitta and the wisdom realizing emptiness are going to keep you straight on the path. And if you don't have them, it's, you know, you can really go way off. Yeah. Okay, then this is also stated in the Array of Tree Trunks Sutra. "O child of my family, the awakening mind is like the seed of all the teachings of the Buddha. It is like the field in which all the positive actions of all wandering beings prosper. It is like the earth on which the whole world depends. It is like the son of the Lord of Wealth, who completely eliminates all kinds of poverty. It is like the father completely protecting all bodhisattvas. It is like the king of wish-granting jewels, which perfectly fulfills every purpose. It is like the miraculous vase which acts to accomplish every wish. It is like a spear vanquishing the foe of disturbing emotions. It is like the armor guarding you from improper thoughts. It is like a sword beheading the disturbing emotions. It is like an axe felling the tree of disturbing emotions. It is like a weapon staving off all kinds of attack. It is like the hook which draws you out of the waters of cyclic existence. It is like the whirlwind which scatters all mental obstructions and their sources. It is like the condensed teaching that encompasses all the prayers and activities of the bodhisattvas. It is like the shrine before which all the gods, humans, and demigods of the world can present their offerings. O child of my family, the awakening mind is endowed like this with these and innumerable other excellent qualities. Okay? So it's very beautiful imagery, isn't it? So you can take this kind of imagery and really explore it in your meditation, you know, and think, well, why does he say it's like a field? Why is it like a seed? Why is it like this? You know? And really think about the imagery and the role of the bodhicitta. It's a way to think about the advantages of the bodhicitta, which is what we're focusing on in this section here. Okay? Because when you know the advantages of bodhicitta, then you want to generate it. Okay, so I want to finish the next two paragraphs, which complete this one section. So the awakening mind is explained in this way as the exclusive entrance. Exclusive! For everybody who wants to be exclusive. The exclusive entrance for venturing into the great vehicle that enables you to accomplish the state of a completely awakened being. The moment it is born within your mind stream, all the obstructions from previously accumulated actions are burnt up. Is that true? That the moment you generate bodhicitta, that all the obstructions from previously created karma is burnt up? No. Okay. Huh? Well, even with ultimate bodhicitta, even your first realization, non-conceptual realization, it doesn't get rid of all the defilements all at once. Yeah? Okay. So this is an example of how they're emphasizing something for the sake of making a point, but we don't need to take it totally literally. Okay? It acts to protect you from all miseries and fear. Okay, will it protect you from all miseries and fear?
Eventually.
Okay. Can bodhicitta alone protect you from the misery of cyclic existence?
No.
Okay. But because with bodhicitta you want to become a Buddha, then generating the wisdom realizing emptiness becomes very important to you. Mm-hmm. And that wisdom realizing emptiness is what helps you eliminate all the miseries and fears. Okay. It begins to provide you with the inexhaustible fruits of higher states of rebirth and the definite goodness of liberation. It is like the quintessential butter arising from the churning of the ocean of scriptures. Okay? I always get this image of scriptures and this Tibetan, you know, the thing they make Tibetan tea in, and you go like this, and like, oh, no, I don't want to do that to a scripture. But what it means is if you're churning milk, you know, the butter comes to the top. So if you were to, quote, quote, churn all the teachings of the Buddha so that the richest, you know, the richest kind of part came to the top, the bodhicitta would come to the top. Okay. It is like the seed that is the exclusive proximate cause leading you to the fully awakened state of being. Is that true? It's the exclusive proximate cause. The proximate cause is the moment before Yeah. So is bodhicitta the only thing going on the moment before you attain enlightenment?
No.
No. Okay, you have to have wisdom going on there. But without that bodhicitta, that wisdom won't lead you to the bodhisattva's path of no more learning. Okay? Yeah, so it's really essential, but maybe not exclusive. In realizing such benefits of the awakening mind, your heart strings should resound with joy. For although life as a free and fortunate human being generally provides you with an opportunity to practice the sacred doctrine, the wonderful discovery of the chance to practice the awakening mind specific to the great vehicle is sure to be a source of great encouragement. This is an event of major importance. Okay? So really knowing the benefits of bodhicitta is something that's very, very important. Because if you don't have an idea of the benefits, you won't want to cultivate it. And if you don't cultivate it, then you won't attain full enlightenment. Okay? So it's very important to meditate on these benefits. Okay, a couple of minutes for questions. You had some homework last week, didn't you?
Mm-hmm. You did.
Yeah, what was your homework? Come up with your own list of the benefits of bodhicitta. So who would like to read it? Let's put the, you can put the telephone. Why don't you start, Kevin? And pass it around. Actually, let me give you the mic, too. And actually, why don't you come sit up here so people can see you?
So on my list was just a peace of mind, much more relaxed way of being, just to get along better with others. More a sense of contentment, a sense of ease, no worries, and really a deep acceptance and understanding of others.
Okay. Are you getting the people on the camera?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, okay.
So it helps overcome your self-centeredness, so it reduces your own suffering. It leads to Buddhahood. You have to cultivate equanimity, love, and compassion to develop it, so your mind is happier. The people around you are happier. Bodhicitta gives your life purpose. Bodhicitta gives hope. It overcomes cynicism and despair. It makes the mind vastly expansive. It overcomes attachment. It gives a good reason to overcome something I can't read, but it must be something awful. You create tons of merit, leads to precious human rebirths, so you continue to practice the path in future lives. It eventually gives you the courage and the compassion of bodhisattvas, and it can be strong enough to take your mind off of superficial difficulties onto something greater.
Okay. Diane?
Very similar. I don't
really
have anything
different.
No?
Yeah.
Okay.
I think it's pretty similar, but...
you got to come up here.
I'm all the way up. Oh. It's out of my hand.
So, same sort of stuff. The life becomes more meaningful, purposeful, has a sense of direction. It improves our ethics and patience, leading to a better future life. You get to put three great eons of benefiting sentient beings on your application for Buddhahood. One size fits all. You could drive off with the Mahayana vehicle today. You could put those supernatural powers to good use. How many people can say they became enlightened for the benefit of others? And then I started thinking about that, some of the same stuff that it benefits us in our current life, and then it benefits us in our future lives, because we do practice ethics more purely this life for our future lives when we want to attain Buddhahood, and then of course ultimately becoming a Buddha.
I didn't write mine down, but I thought about them. So one is that you move from a joy to a joy, just a feeling. And another is just my own personal thought of that, because it seems like it's such a complete antidote to a self-centered thought. That's huge. I mean, that would be wonderful. It's a kind of merit, you know, a kind of virtue that never gets
consumed.
So every other virtue we have can be consumed. And then the other is, I can't personally see how you could do this path without bodhicitta. That's just my own view.
Tempa?
I didn't make a list because I could only think of one thing, and that's exactly what you were talking about at the beginning of the teaching, which is that it's the only thing that really seems to have any true purpose. As compared to anything else, everything else falls short. And the reason that is because if one is to attain, if one does attain Buddhahood, then you'll be able to benefit people without anything stopping you from your own side, which is just incredible.
Okay, so it's time to close. That's very good that you are thinking about the benefits of bodhicitta. So continue this week to think about the benefits and really do some meditation on it.
May the spiritual teachers who lead me on the sacred path, and all spiritual friends who practice it have long life. May I pacify completely all other inner hindrances, grant such inspiration, I pray. May the lives of the venerable spiritual masters be stable, and their divine actions spread in the 10 directions. May the light of Losong's teachings dispelling the darkness of the beings in the three worlds always increase. Idam Guru Ratnam Mangalakam this merit, may we soon attain the enlightened state of Guru Buddha, that we may be able to liberate all sentient beings from their suffering. May the precious Bodhi mind, not yet born, arise and grow. May that born have no decline, but increase forevermore. In the snowy mountain paradise, you're the source of good and happiness. Powerful tens and gaps of your mercy, may you stay until samsara ends. May the deeds of explaining and practicing the Dharma, done by groups supporting the teachings and their upholders, who spread the view of dependence arising and nonviolent actions in the 10 directions, and especially at Shravasti Abbey in the West, flourish.